Today on the 21st Show, a new book tells the story of American nuclear power, past, present, and future, through the lens of the former power station in Zion, Illinois. It was a town founded by a religious prophet who would fall from grace. And nearly a century later, Zion would once again be let down, this time by the promise of the atomic age. The book is Higher Power, an American town story of faith, hope, and nuclear energy. The author is Casey Buckrow. We'll be talking with him for the hour. I'm Brian Mackey, and that's coming up today on The 21st Show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media. Airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WCBU in Peoria, WNIJ in DeKalb, WVIK in the Quad Cities, and WSIU in Carbondale. But first, the news. From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. And today we will be talking about nuclear energy with a journalist whose writing career has spanned nearly the entire length of the industry. The atomic age was birthed here in Illinois. Scientists working in secret out of the University of Chicago created the first man-made atomic reaction. The effort was spurred in part by the demands of a world at war, and soon enough, the world would see the full destructive power of our scientific achievements.
A short time ago, an American airplane dropped one bomb on Hiroshima and destroyed its usefulness to the enemy.
President Truman delivering the news from aboard the USS Augusta, August 6, 1945.
It is an atomic bomb. It is a harnessing of the basic power of the universe. The force from which the sun draws its power has been loosed against those who brought war to the Far East.
America would not be the world's only nuclear power for long. 4 years after Hiroshima, the Soviet Union tested its first nuclear weapon. But even after the Cold War arms race had begun, there were those offering a more peaceful vision of the atomic age.
It is not enough to take this weapon out of the hands of the soldiers. It must be put into the hands of those who will know how to strip its military casing and adapt it to the arts of peace.
President Dwight Eisenhower at the United Nations, December 8, 1953. The speech is known as Atoms for Peace.
The United States knows that if the fearful trend of atomic military buildup can be reversed, this greatest of destructive forces can be developed into a great boom for the benefit of all mankind. The United States knows that peaceful power from atomic energy is no dream of the future. That capability, already proved, is here, now, today. Who can doubt if the entire body of the world's scientists and engineers had adequate amounts of fissionable material with which to test and develop their ideas, that this capability would rapidly be transformed into universal, efficient, and economic usage?
Eisenhower's vision would only be partly realized. Despite what the book of Isaiah tells us, it turns out that with enough money, you can have both swords and plowshares. And as the arms race continued, so did the development of nuclear energy. And that is where our program begins. Illinois is a state of superlatives with regard to nuclear power. We have more reactors, the most generating capacity, and get the highest share of our power from nuclear than any other state. And for a quarter century, some of that power came from a generating station in the town of Zion, Illinois. Situated on the shore of Lake Michigan, about 40 miles north of Chicago, Zion was an unlikely home for a monument to American scientific know-how. It had been founded in 1900 by a self-styled religious prophet named John Alexander Dowie. He was a faith healer, his successor was a flat earther, and they both ran the town as a theocracy. Dowie eventually fell from grace, and so did the nuclear power station in Zion. And even though humankind is desperately seeking an energy source that will stop cooking our atmosphere, the future of nuclear power is an open question. All this and more is the subject of the book Higher Power, an American town story of faith, hope, and nuclear energy. The author is Casey Buckrow. He began working for the Chicago Tribune in 1961 and became the paper's environmental reporter in 1970. Through that work, he would eventually spend the better part of 2 years embedded at the Zion Power Station. Higher Power is about that time, the wild history of Zion, and the future of nuclear energy. Casey Buckrow, welcome to the 21st Show. Thank you for being with us today.
Good morning, Brian. That's a great introduction, and I do appreciate it.
So, listeners, I also want to invite you, as ever, to join our conversation at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. We're going to be talking about some about the town of Zion. We're going to talk about the power plant. And toward the end of our conversation, we'll be talking about the future of nuclear energy. So if you want to chime in on one of those points, try and wait for the appropriate moment. But 800-222-9455 is the number. So, Casey, let's begin, as you do in the book, with the history, a brief history of Zion. Who was John Alexander Dowie?
Well, without a doubt, he was one of the first faith healers to get rich doing what he did. But he was also considered a swindler. But he created this. He's a very complicated person. He did really great things through faith healing, but he also sold stock in worthless companies. It's been suggested that Zion really was a platform for fraud. But so history is not as clear as sometimes we wish. And I was drawn to Zion mainly because I was covering the Zion nuclear power plant, which had the distinction of being the only nuclear power plant ever investigated by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission for allegations of sexual activity inside the plant, consumption of alcohol and drugs. It did not take, so that was totally unusual. It did not take me long to discover that the town in which the power plant was located also was very unusual. It was considered to be heaven on earth by people who lived there. It was considered a utopia, a theocracy, heaven on earth. And think of heaven on earth being 40 miles away from Chicago, which by some accounts is one of the most sinful places, corrupt places in the country.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I couldn't pass that up.
Yeah, no, it is quite a contrast. And so Dowie is this fascinating character. He's Scottish. He spends time in Australia. He spends time in California. He sets up a church just outside of the grounds of the Great Columbian Exposition in 1893. He founds this community in 1900. It has some very interesting features. You couldn't buy a lot. You could only lease it for 1,100 years, apparently, because that's, you know, Christ was coming back in 100 years and he would reign for 1,000 years. What was it like to actually live in Zion in the early days?
It was heavily influenced by pageantry, religious pageantry. You were not allowed to spit, to dance, to sing other than religious songs. You had to go to church. They had the police in town had Bibles in their holsters, and you stopped twice a day to pray in the morning and in the evening. It was dominated by religion, and people liked it. That's the way they wanted to live. They thought it was a Christian community, but very, very strict in terms of no alcohol, no tobacco. Didn't even want medical doctors. They thought medical doctors were charlatans, and so it was. It had it, and then again, it. The leaders thought the world was flat. They didn't believe in medical science. But that's the way they lived, and that's the way they liked it.
Yeah, and Dowie, he starts out as just a more conventional preacher, I guess, fire and brimstone, preaching the evils of tobacco and alcohol. But then he kind of hits on this trend in that, I guess, what would you say, the Victorian era, the late 1800s of seances and communing with the dead, and kind of learns some of those skills, becomes, as you mentioned, a faith healer. One of his church buildings has all these old crutches and things that people supposedly no longer needed on the walls. You mentioned that he was th- thought by some as a con man. What conclusion did you come to, if you did, as to whether he was ultimately, you know, sincerely believed himself a prophet or was just running a very long con?
I think eventually he convinced himself that he was indeed a prophet. I think he glamorized himself to the point that he believed his own propaganda. But he's not an easy man to define because he did a certain amount of good, as the book points out. But he also was somewhat of a charlatan. He knew he wasn't getting anywhere as a small town preacher. He discovered what he called a big show where he called through fraud, through sham, he had people crawl up to the stages pretending to be very sick or very crippled, and then he would bless them and they would get up and run around and pretend to be totally healed. He said that it wasn't enough to have a small town practice. He wanted to give people a big show, a big religious show, and that's what would turn people on. And it worked for him for many, many years.
It works until it doesn't, and then he does have a fall from grace. And we don't have to get too much into that. People can read it in the book if they want. But what are the consequences for the town of Zion as he had structured it as basically a company town for his church?
It was a company town, and the company was religion. And he was Dowley owned everything. It all belonged to him. But he was no money manager. He and his wife lived extravagantly, toured the world, lived in the best places, spent lavishly. And eventually, the town went bankrupt several times. And that's one of the reasons he was basically exiled by his own people, because he couldn't sustain his community because it went bankrupt. But we should add, as the book points out, that there are now something like 15 to 20 million people in Africa who consider themselves children of Zion. And when they say that, the Zion they mention is Zion, Illinois. So what Dowie created still very much exists, although his heaven on earth descended into conflict, people fighting with each other, factions split up, and what Dowie envisioned as a city of brotherly love became nothing but conflict and not at all what Dowie envisioned.
So we're going to fast forward through time, because that religious conflict, Zion does eventually settle into more of a, I guess, somewhat more of an ordinary community. And by mid-century, it's looking to become a nuclear town. How does that happen?
Well, 70 years later, oddly enough, this town that pretty much ignored or shunned science became the site for one of the monuments of science, which is a nuclear power plant. You mentioned earlier in your introductions that people became aware of nuclear power through bombs. People in the nuclear power industry have always regretted that. They were hoping that nuclear power generation, getting electricity from nuclear power, had been the beginning of nuclear power, because even now, the whole idea of nuclear power is tainted by the idea of explosions, bombs, killing people. But eventually, Zion became a nuclear town, not a religious town. Although even today, I mean, there is still the influence Dowie had on that town. You don't find a bar or a saloon in Zion even today. So it still is very much influenced by the thoughts of how it began. But along came nuclear power.
Yeah, which makes the story we'll come to in a little bit about the sort of the investigation into drugs, alcohol, and sex at the plant all the more interesting, given for where it was located. We need to take a break in a couple of minutes, but let's just talk briefly about the actual sort of beginning of the plant. It's cited, you write in the book, in the 1960s, most power generating stations burned coal. State and federal environment and safety regulations had not yet caught up with this new thing called nuclear energy. Essentially, the Zion Generating Station was built to meet the standards for coal burning stations. So again, in about, you know, a minute and a half until we break, what were the people building the Zion nuclear power station and their regulators getting wrong about where to place it?
The Zion plant could not be built where it is today because it's too close to Lake Michigan. But they weren't even thinking about that. The only thought that Commonwealth Edison had was that it was a good location for a power plant of any kind. It was close to Lake Michigan, which is the drinking water source for millions of people. That plant would not be allowed there today, or any power generating plant, because regulations, safety concerns caught up finally with the technology. Very often we get technology and we run with it until we start thinking about the dangers involved, the hazards involved. We tend to think about that later. But it was a good location. It had water. It was close to the source where the electricity was needed, close to Chicago. Chicago accounted for a great part of the power consumed by that it was generated by Commonwealth Edison. So it was close to the areas where power was needed. So that was one of the key points.
Yeah, it's a good location if you're not thinking about the potential risk to millions and millions of people in both their drinking water.
No thoughts about risk, just about where to put someplace, a power plant where it was most needed for in terms of power production and power consumption.
Yeah, all right. So we're going to take a break and we will continue talking about this. And just as a bit of a teaser, from the get-go, Zion has some issues and attracts the wrong kind of attention from nuclear regulators. We will talk more about that with Casey Buckrow. His book is Higher Power. This is the 21st Show. Stay with us. This is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are speaking with journalist Casey Buckrow. He was a longtime reporter at the Chicago Tribune, was the paper's first environmental reporter in the 1970s and 80s, when that was still a relatively rare thing in journalism. And during that time, he spent 2 years embedded at the Zion Nuclear Power Station in Zion, Illinois, about 40 miles north of Chicago. Now he has turned those experiences, as well as a history of Zion and a look at the future of nuclear power, into a book. It's called Higher Power, an American Town Story of Faith, Hope, and Nuclear Energy. 800-222-9455 is the number to join our conversation today. 800-222-9455. We did ask members of our texting group about what you think about nuclear energy, nuclear power. We heard a range of opinions. Tommy in Urbana said, "Nuclear power seems like a retreat to thinking we'll never invent any other clean energy source." And Tommy says he was a certified welder in 3 nuclear plants. Ginger in the Springfield area said, "At my age of 75, I'm afraid of it, yet I know it holds the potential for improving our lives." And John in Springfield said, "Pick your poison. Not so slow march to climate disaster or years of nuclear material storage with its fallout. Seems like modern society is in direct conflict with our natural environment. We'll destroy ourselves and the Earth will adapt without us." Rather pessimistic vision from John there, but thank you for writing in. We will come back to some of those questions a little later in the program. 800-222-9455. Before the break, we were talking about the Zion Power Plant. It's built in late 60s, early 70s. It finally, 2 nuclear reactors come online, 1973, 1974. And right away, the station starts getting the wrong kind of attention from federal regulators. Casey Buckrow, what was happening there?
The the scandal that eventually swept over the station began with a drug bust. Two employees of the power plant were caught selling drugs outside the plant after a one-year investigation by police. Turns out that one of these people arrested, they were both employees of Commonwealth Edison, but one of them was in training to become a reactor operator. That raised the possibility that somehow somebody, some drug-addled person might get their hands on the controls of a nuclear power reactor. Scared the heck out of a lot of people. And that started the whole thing. And it got a lot of headlines, a lot of TV coverage. And that really upset the station superintendent, Ken Grazer. And he called me and he said, I want to talk to you. Please come down to the station. So I did. And he said he thought all of this was being blown out of proportion, that nuclear power is operated under extreme regulations, very careful. And he thought the whole thing was being bent out of shape. He said, I really wish you could be here and see how we really operate. To which I said, okay, thanks, hire me. He didn't expect that, but he said, okay. He went back to his supervisors at Commonwealth Edison, and finally they gave me clearance to go inside the plant as long as I took radiation training and passed the tests. You have to, everybody who gets into a reactor, a plant, a nuclear plant, has to take radiation protection training. I did that, I passed the test, and that got me inside the plant because I'm a reporter. I want to see what happens in a nuclear power plant. Who are the people who work in radioactivity? Why do they do that? A lot of them are women who have to learn how to protect themselves from radiation. And that was basically what I was doing while I was covering the Zion nuclear power plant. They were in a 10-year shutdown, a 10-year maintenance program after the first unit had operated for 10 years. And they were taking the whole place, the reactor down, dismantling it to see what happens after 10 years and restoring it. And that gave me a chance to go inside the power plant, inside the reactor containment building to actually see the fuel, nuclear fuel, which glows blue when it's really hot. It's called Cherenkov's radiation. Very few people get to see that, although when you're looking at it, you're getting radiated. So I took radiation doses, potentially harmful to my health. That's true of anybody who works in a nuclear power plant because radiation does damage cells. They tell you that in radiation training, that when you're in a radioactive area, you're being exposed, cells are being injured. But it's like, they say it's like a cut. A cut heals itself as long as the cut is not deep and severe. Same thing with radiation. If you get too much radiation, too much damage, you could wind up sick or dead, including from cancer.
Yeah, I suppose to take your metaphor, it's the difference between a cut with a steak knife and a cut with a broadsword, perhaps.
That's about right. But yeah. I took that risk as most people do when they agree to go into a nuclear power plant. You do it because most people do it for a paycheck. I did it because I wanted to know what goes on in there and report.
I'm curious about the people who work there, because you even before the scandal that was sort of the headline and is one of the centerpiece stories of the book about sex, drugs, and alcohol in the plant, some of that was never really substantiated from my read of the reports as you convey them. Some of them was among the security guards, not necessarily among the people with their hands on the controls themselves. But even before this, through the 70s, and this scandal, I should say, was in early 1980s. But even before that, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission was getting increasingly worried about some of the things happening at Zion. One of them, I was very interested in the story of a man who went into a highly radioactive area against the advice of safety experts on site. And you pose the question in the book, why would anyone ignore advice against going into a highly radioactive area? How would you answer that question?
I think people, it's like smoking. When you smoke, you don't see any immediate injuries, repercussions from smoking. I think a mindset begins. You've been exposed to radiation. There might be a certain amount of bravado in the whole thing, but I think once you're in the business, you're exposed to radiation, nothing is happening health-wise immediately. I think they just become indifferent. My first exposure to radiation, I was nervous, as most people who get their first radiation dose, they're uptight about it. I was concerned about it. I wanted to know, even though I had the training, I was all suited up in anti-contamination clothing. My skin began to tingle. The skin on my face began to tingle. It's one of the things I remember about my first entry into the reactor containment building. It was strictly my imagination, but because radiation doesn't cause your skin to tingle, but that's the feeling I had. But I went through the same process that most go through. Eventually you get accustomed to it and then you hope for the best. When I finally got was told I could no longer go to the plant, I went, I had 40 millirems of exposure. I got periodic reports from the NRC about my exposure levels, as do all employees working in radiation. And I went to one of the radiation specialists and I said, well, what does that mean to my health? 40 millirems of exposure. He said, maybe a 4 in a million increased chance of cancer in your lifetime. That was the answer given to me. But it shows that people working in nuclear power plants are taking a health risk. And it turns out later studies show that leukemia is the greatest risk. And about 1 to 2, it's a work hazard. It's an occupational hazard. And about 1 to 2% of power plant workers come down with illnesses related to radiation exposure.
Let me remind listeners, this is the 21st show. We're speaking with author and journalist Casey Buckrow. He's written a book called Higher Power, An American Town Story of Faith, Hope, and Nuclear Energy. He embedded for 2 years at the Zion Nuclear Power Station back in the 1980s when he was environmental reporter at the Chicago Tribune, and continued to follow the fate of Zion, both as a reporter and even after he stopped being a sort of full-time day-to-day reporter at the Tribune, and he's turned those experiences into this book. I was interested, and I had sort of an impression that people who worked in nuclear plants, who ran nuclear power stations, were all sort of ex-Navy, you know, they'd run the nuclear reactors on submarines, maybe college people. But that, at least when you started and in the early days, was definitely not the norm. These were often working people. They had sort of started as maybe janitors or laborers in the plant and worked their way up to become nuclear operators. I'm wondering what impression you had of, or what you thought about, the people working in the plant before you actually went and embedded there, and how that changed from actually spending time with them.
You said it precisely right, that I thought, like a lot of people, that you had to have a degree, a college degree in nuclear physics to have your hands on a nuclear power reactor. Totally wrong. I discovered at that time, this has all probably changed, but at that time, as you point out, people starting as janitors or equipment handlers work their way up to be reactor operators, and they had no more than a high school education. That probably has changed by now, but gradually some engineers kept the force of engineers going into that business guru. One thing I remember, however, about the people who worked there, most of them hated reporters. They thought reporters were responsible for their poor acceptance by people in general. They thought the media did that, nothing that they did. So I got basically some pretty hostile response and some cursing in the plan simply because I was a reporter. But I compared their attitude to soldiers coming back from Vietnam who thought they were misunderstood, mistreated, treated badly. And that same kind of attitude existed at nuclear power plants, at the staff, as I understood it, as I saw it at the Zion nuclear power plant. But, and yes, at that time, people who started with a high school education were the people who had their controls, hands-on controls of the nuclear reactors. That changed. I saw in a brief period of time that the Three Mile Island accident required more professional engineering background to keep control, to understand what was going on at a nuclear power plant and to deal with any accidents, and more professional people, more engineers, trained engineers were coming onto the scene as a result of that. But it was an interesting time to see that.
In Three Mile Island, there's a whole, we won't have time to get into it today, but you were on the ground there reporting in Pennsylvania as that was unfolding and getting a pretty significant scoop, if I read it correctly. You use the sort of third person, as newspapermen do, but about how that unfolded. I want to skip ahead, though, to the end of Zion. You mentioned the people who have their hands on their controls. In Zion, you know, nuclear plants don't last forever. They're fated to have lifetimes. But Zion's was shorter than expected. And that was in part because of the actions of someone who had their hands on the controls and behaved in a way that sort of shocked regulators and other experts in the field. Can you briefly tell that story?
One of the reactor operators at Zion did something that horrified not only the NRC, but the nuclear power community in general. And that is that the operator was told to bring the reactor level, operating level, down to sort of like perking along, but not shut off. At Zion had two reactors, and one was already shut down for refueling. And this particular reactor was going through some power changes and waiting to go back up into full power. So the reactor operator was told to bring the power level down and just above shutoff. But for reasons that were never quite explained, the reactor operator shut the reactor off, and in panic, he turned it back up. You're not supposed to do things like that in a nuclear power plant. You don't do things suddenly. You only do things through pre-planning. Everything you learned about operating a reactor was violated there. He did he turned off the power and then he put it back on, and without saying anything to anybody, without any pre-planning, that essentially doomed the power station, because that was unacceptable. And eventually, that was in 1997. In 98, Commonwealth Edison decided to shut the plant down, the entire plant down, permanently, 15 years after it was supposed to be shut down. But I should add that the power plant also had a demonstration, or some call it a rebellion, by the nuclear power reactor operators.
Against the managers from ComEd. And that is a great tease, because we need to take another break, and we will tell that story when we return and also take a bigger picture look at what Zion's fate meant for the town of Zion, what Zion has been left with, and what its great costs have been. and the future of nuclear power in general. We're speaking with Casey Buckrow, the journalist and author. His book is Higher Power, an American Town Story of Faith, Hope, and Nuclear Energy. This is the 21st show. More to come. Please stay with us. This is the 21st show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are continuing our conversation with journalist Casey Buckrow. He was a longtime environmental reporter, the first environmental reporter at the Chicago Tribune. He spent 2 years embedded at the Zion Nuclear Power Station in Zion, Illinois, about 40 miles north of Chicago, near the Wisconsin border. And he's turned that experience and a history of the town as well, and a meditation on the future of nuclear energy, into the book Higher Power, an American Town Story of Faith, Hope, and Nuclear Energy. 800-222-9455 is the number to join us today. 800-222-9455. You know, Casey, I recently came across a Union of Concerned Scientists webpage. They have this feature where you can get a series of stories under the heading, I Wish I Didn't Know That. And I kind of feel that way about a number of the sections in your book. And one of them you were hinting at before the break is, which is, when the workers at the plant, the control room operators, unionized, were really rebelling, in open rebellion, it seems, against their managers. This happened after the sort of disastrous shutdown, that, not disastrous, that's overstating it, after the concerning shutdown in that we were talking about in the late 1990s. ComEd still thought it could bring the plant back online for a number of years. But then you had, as you were mentioning, this rebellion of the staff.
The Zion Nuclear Power Plant was unlike any other in the nation. And that rebellion by the nuclear power operators was one example of that. One thing after another, including the fact that Edison was fined repeatedly for mistakes, for things that violated the regulations. That's one of the reasons I wrote the book. This plant was unlike any other, and it was not all good. And finally, a industry watchdog, the Institute for Nuclear Power Operations, these are people who run nuclear power plants, came out with a report which was scorching, just absolutely scorching, when it came to describing how poorly the Commonwealth Edison nuclear power plant operation was. They call us the worst in the nation among all nuclear utilities. So that's one of the things that prompted the book. This all happened right in our backyard. I mean, if you live in Chicago, all this was going on 40 miles from where you live, and under NRC nuclear preparedness planning. They have a 50-mile radius zones that in which certain precautions must be taken in case of an accident. In other words, if you live within that 50-mile zone, which would include Chicago, you would be told to take cover or evacuate, depending on how serious the accident was. So people tend to think, well, it doesn't make any difference to me. Well, if you lived anywhere close to a nuclear power plant, it sure does. Even now, although the plant itself was demolished, it's been decommissioned, and the plant itself is gone. Large portions of the plant remain underground, and 2.2 million pounds of highly radioactive waste are still on that site. And that is close, but a few hundred yards distant from the shores of Lake Michigan, the source of drinking water. So this highlights the fact that we've not only if you live close to a nuclear power plant, you have to be aware that you might be called upon to take emergency action. But secondly, because we have no permanent disposal sites for nuclear waste, this stuff is piling up at the plant sites. And that's another thing to worry about.
Yeah, and you think of how many, as I mentioned, Illinois has more nuclear power generators than any, or reactors than any other state. There are a significant
Illinois
number
has
of people.
11 reactors at six sites, and it generates 50% of the state's electricity.
Ultimately, this is a process. I think it's fair to say, correct me if I'm wrong, but the last sort of light switch or light bulb powered by Zion would have been in the late 90s. And it wasn't until November 8th, 2023, just a couple months ago, that its Part 50 license was effectively terminated by the NRC. That's the one of the regulatory sections that governs nuclear power plants, outside of remaining on-site ISFSI, which is what you mentioned, Independent Spent Fuel Storage Installation. The closure of this plant was devastating for Zion's property tax base. A bunch of people left town. There's much more rental housing. It has a reputation, as you document in the book, as a tough town. And that's all worth reading and considering. But I do want to take in about the 10 minutes we have remaining and think a little more broadly about the future of nuclear power. You quote the former mayor of Zion, Al Hill, saying, "The age of nuclear power is over and the age of decommissioning is upon us." Do you agree with that?
I'm not going to go that far yet because I think the Joker turned up, and the Joker is climate change. Just when you think you have it all figured out, things change in the world, and climate change is one of those things. The Guardian newspaper just last month said nuclear power generation is likely to break records in 2025 as more countries invest in reactors because of the shift to low carbon economy, while renewable energy is likely to overtake coal as a power source early next year. If this is true, we're having a major shift in the way we do business in the nuclear and in the energy field. We've got wind, solar, and other clean energy sources. Renewables are likely to be to make up a third of all the total electricity globally by next year. If that is true, then that provides an opening, a possible opening for nuclear, because nuclear is at least one of the technologies that does not create the greenhouse gases. Of course, it creates nuclear waste. One of the things that we don't do in this country is recycle nuclear waste. France, which gets 70% of its energy and electricity from nuclear power, recycles 17% of its recycles its nuclear waste and gets 17% of its power from recycled waste. We don't do that in this country. Jimmy Carter in 1977 said we shouldn't go in that direction. There were concerns about people seizing plutonium from recycling plant and making bombs out of it. We might consider going back to the whole idea of recycling nuclear waste to make it usable rather than, as it is now, just piling up at all power stations.
I want to share a couple more comments we got from listeners by text message. John in Harvard, Illinois said, "Nuclear, especially inherently safe generation for advanced nuclear, it's the only solution available 24/7, 365 through good weather and bad that can provide vast amounts of energy at scale for a world that needs to lift 3 billion people out of energy poverty." He talks about how intermittent some of the renewable sources are, which leads to privation and poverty. He says nuclear is the only carbon-free energy that doesn't need refueling for years at a time and does not need astoundingly expensive and environmentally damaging batteries. It's the only energy we can scale to match fossil that we can deploy immediately. We heard similar thoughts from Christina in Rock Falls, who says she's lived within 10 miles of the Byron nuclear generating station for 13 years, never worried about it. And Stephen, who was a high school technology and engineering teacher who got to tour the Clinton nuclear power plant and said he had grown up in southern Illinois near two coal-fired plants, which had rail cars lined up every day, dumping tons and tons of coal nonstop. And that experience compared with you know, this one small pool that he got to see at Clinton, you know, made him, sold him on nuclear. How about that? How safe, right? The most famous nuclear disasters happened at Fukushima, Japan, Chernobyl in Ukraine, and Three Mile Island, Pennsylvania. I know you were on site and covering Three Mile Island. Those first two were much more severe, level 7. Three Mile Island was a level 5. That's how the International Atomic Energy Agency classified it. But you also write that there have been 33 serious nuclear power incidents. Do you think nuclear power is safe?
Well, let me start by saying that those comments referring to from your listeners show just how controversial nuclear power is. There are some for it, some against it. And one of the things we have to keep in consideration in a democracy, what people want and vote for makes a big difference. And that's one of the problems with nuclear waste disposal. People don't want it anywhere close to where they live. Not in my backyard is the way they call it. And the NB phenomenon. Now, is nuclear power safe? My bottom line in nuclear power is these reactors are only as safe and as good as the people operating them. Three Mile Island happened because of serious human errors. Chernobyl happened because of serious human errors. Fukushima, of course, came about because of a natural phenomenon, tidal waves, earthquakes, and that's what caused that serious accident.
Although perhaps improperly planned for by humans.
And putting those plans on earthquake faults, that probably is not a good thing to do. And they probably knew it at the time, but nobody expected that kind of earthquake, that kind of tidal wave, that kind of tsunami. But that shows how short-sighted people are. And when we think about burying these wastes for 10,000 years or more, because this waste is dangerous for thousands of years until it cools off, how do you mark the area with warnings? What language would people in 10,000 years use? No civilization, no human civilization has lasted 10,000 years. What language, how would you mark these places as being extremely dangerous, which should not be tampered with? I mean, these are some of the questions that nuclear power raises. My bottom line is it's only as good as the planning people do and how effective they are in what they do. And we see again and again, human error is often the reason things go bad, including the Three Mile Island accident.
And that's the key point, right? You write about the man-machine interface, the human-machine interface. And to adapt a question from something in the book, is nuclear technology beyond the ability of power plant workers to comprehend and control?
Well, the people in the nuclear power business say no, they can handle it, that we're smart enough to deal with it. Well, I think, no, so far the indications are, if we look at the accidents we've had, that we're not as smart as we need to be sometimes. But I guess that's true of any kind of technology we use. We kill a lot of people with cars. We kill a lot of people with cigarettes. We kill a lot of people with alcohol. Are people as safety-minded as they should be? It comes down to human behavior and precautions that people may or may not take.
The book is called Higher Power, An American Town Story of Faith, Hope, and Nuclear Energy. The author is Casey Buckrow. Casey, thank you so much for being with us today on The 21st Show.
Thank you, Brian. We'll be right back.
Coming up tomorrow on the program, it's our Friday news roundups, including the latest on a funeral home in central Illinois accused of mixing up the human remains that it returned to grieving families, and a pair of Illinois Republicans, one a state lawmaker, one a candidate for Congress, visiting the U.S.-Mexico border as a deal to secure the border falls apart in the Senate, scuttled by members of their own party. We're going to be talking about all that in our Friday news and politics roundups tomorrow on the 21st show. Our program is produced by Christine Hatfield, Kennedy Vincent, and Jose Zepeda. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. The 21st show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We will talk with you again tomorrow.